I call this meeting of House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, March 1st, 2023. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Flom, Representative Lortoz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. We are being assisted today by our LIO moderator, Emma Turner, and our Finance Secretary, Leah Frazier. We will be hearing two department budget overviews today. The first we will hear is the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and presenting will be Commissioner Torrence Sachs. General Simon Brown, the Commander of the State Alaska Defense Force, and Administrative Services Director Bob Ernice. Commissioner Sachs, will you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and bring anyone else up and introduce them for your presentation.
Good afternoon, Major General Torrence Sachs, DMVA, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
For the record, Bob Ernice, Admin Services Director.
Simon Brown, State Defense Force Commander.
Welcome to House Finance. You may begin your presentation.
Here's our mission statement. In a nutshell, this is protection and defense of our state and nation. Next slide, please. I want to show this. This is what it looked like in 1995. So every box you see, these are armories. And in the mid-90s, every single one had soldiers, and they were all full. So this is done for at least two reasons. One, if there was a natural disaster, we had troops that were already out in Western Alaska and all over the state. But also if there was a federal threat. So it's changed quite a bit over the years. Now, if you take a look at the slide, all the ones that have a green box, those are the ones that we're focusing on. Those are the ones we're trying to recruit to in present day.
One moment. Please. Hands back on the record.
So just a very good visual of how things have changed over the past number of years. So we are trying to recruit, in particular in Western Alaska, but all over the state. But right now, if there were to be a natural disaster, such as a typhoon response, we need to get troops out to a given area within Alaska. And years ago, they were already out there. So next slide, please. This is our biggest response off the road system in many years, the typhoon response, Murbach. We don't have a whole lot of troops in that area of the state, so it really was what we call a spoke and wheel concept. We had a large contingent in Nome and one in Bethel, and to get around to make sure that we're doing what we need to do. But if you think back to the previous slide, all the places that we used to have armories and troops, a lot of the same places on this slide are now depicted. So getting to roughly 30-some communities, it was a challenge. And what we would like to do is have a means to have troops, most likely State Defense Force, in a lot of these small communities, so they could be the first ones to respond to a natural disaster. For the small number that we had during the typhoon response, the first ones to respond were, of course, the ones that lived out in that area. So this is part of the recruiting effort and part of what we're going to talk about today. Next slide, please. Did want to mention the balloon. That's been in the news quite a bit. I'm going to make that plural for balloons. But the reason this is so important, it really is on a couple fronts. Number one, it's something coming into our sovereign territory. Number two, there's always been the question, why a balloon versus a satellite? A balloon can see more depending where it's at because it's closer to the Earth than a satellite. The surveillance, the intelligence, things of that nature. And just in a common sense, it is a threat to aviation. If someone were to be flying by at 400, 500 knots and to hit this balloon, that could be catastrophic. So I'm happy to answer any questions on this as well, but this is something that we're watching for and something that is very important to us to make sure we're doing it right. Next slide. As far as the organization for DMVA, this is quite different than you would find in most states. In most states, the Adjutant General just has the military. We have quite a few state entities as well within our department. But just going around, I've been trying for quite a while to get the Civil Air Patrol and DMVA, and we finally do have them. They are an official part of the United States Air Force, so we're glad to have them, and they're, of course, part of the overall force to respond to natural disasters and rescue. Alaska Aerospace, we have administrative control over them. It is made up of a board. That's who picks the officers within that organization, but as I said, administrative oversight. Did want to concentrate a bit on the organized militia, as we call that, the Air National Guard, the Army National Guard, the State Defense Force, and the Naval Militia. So we are the only state or territory within the U.S. that has a larger Air National Guard than Army. I would argue that we are the most operational National Guard in the entire nation. We have virtually every 24/7 mission within the state. Fort Greely, clear, of course, rescue, and that's roughly one rescue per week. The PJs in particular are getting out there with the C-130s, and we have alert up at Eielson Air Force Base with the KC-135s. So as far as the State Defense Force, that is the official state militia. They can never be federalized. So if we can go back one slide, I want to point out something. One more. Anyway, as far as the map of Alaska, if there ever were to be a situation where the federal forces were to leave the state, let's say for a peer threat, if there ever were to be a situation where the National Guard was federalized, let's say for a peer threat, I did want to point out that during World War II, the Alaska National Guard did leave the state of Alaska and went to Washington State. I am in no way saying this is going to happen, but as a student of history, as many of us are within the military, that's something that I do look as far as what the historical precedent would be. But again, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I would like to have at least a seed of people here for natural disasters or whatever may come. Next slide. Go back to the. So as far as the Naval Militia, those are primarily Naval Reservists. They can come on state orders and do things as far as natural disasters and have done this quite a bit over the past few years. Other things within the department, we have Veterans Affairs and also Homeland Security and Emergency Management. That really is a busy division. Over the past year, we have tied the all-time record for the number of natural disasters within the state. So over the past 5 years, we just did some checking, and it's about 60. This is a very busy time for natural disasters, not just hurricanes and typhoons, things of that nature, but fires, of course, for people that lived in the Anchorage area around 2018, big response there as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
The chair for General Sachs. The Civil Air Patrol was something the legislature repeatedly funded and the governor repeatedly vetoed to $0 in terms of state contribution. Do you know if that's in the budget this year?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it is. Last year it made it into the budget and was not vetoed, and so it is continued into this year's budget as well.
Thank you.
But also through the chair, they really have been an incredible partner. And as far as what they're doing, it's been on my mind for a couple years. They cannot be separate. They have to be under the military department because they are an official part of the United States Air Force. So anything for natural disaster response, they're now right there with what we call the joint staff going forward, making plans, making sure that we utilize all the assets accordingly.
Thank you.
For the record, Bob Ernstey, Admin Services Director. The intent of this slide is to show a high-level comparison between FY20 actuals and FY24 governor's request. You'll notice that UGF overall has stayed fairly consistent with a few notable exceptions. In FY21, ALMR Stats, the Alaska Land Mobile Radio, and the State of Alaska Telecommunications System was transferred from DOA over to DMVA. And then you'll note in FY23, those systems were transferred again to DPS. So they are no longer with us, and that's why the spike in GF there. The other notable exception is in FY23, we saw an increase to help stand up the Alaska State Defense Force, and in FY24, you'll notice later on in our slide presentation that we're increasing that as well, or requesting to increase that. So our first request here is in the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, And this is a decrement of 700,000 federal authority. It's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration funding, and we're actually just transferring this funding to our capital budget. It's a multi-year grant, and we find that it fits much better in the capital budget than it does in the operating. So when you guys see the capital budget, you'll see an increase in federal authority for that. Second on here is for the Emergency Management Performance Grant, and this is an increase in general funds based on the increase in match. We've received the grant has gone up, and so the state's match needs to go up to meet that grant as well. And then the final one on here is a decrease in statutory designated program receipts in relation to our Emergency Management Assistant Compact. And what this was our ability to, when other states have national disasters, natural disasters, we were able to respond and help those states, and we find we no longer have the capacity to do that, and we have to concentrate on Alaska. As the commissioner said, the disasters have been at a record pace recently.
Madam Chair.
Representative Panner.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Ernest, could you just elaborate a little more on the first, the deficit, the transfer to the capital budget? What was the original project, and what is it that you're anticipating that $700,000 receipt authority to do?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hannon. So this was a grant. This was a grant for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it was mostly for personal services cost for communities to meet this grant. There are some other aspects of it that I would be happy to get to you in writing. I seem to misplace my notes. But we're continuing on with the grant. We are still executing the grant. We just are moving it to our capital budget instead of our operating.
One follow-up. So do you know what the grant is for? I mean, I understand it's kind of known.
I do have that information, just not on the Representative Hannon, and okay. Would be able to get it to you in writing.
On the Emergency Management Performance Grant, I hope I didn't miss this. How much were the general fund match requirement for that?
Through the chair, or Chair Johnson, $3.6 million.
$3.6?
Yes.
All right. And how much was the federal increase?
The federal increase also brought it to 3.6. It's a 50-50 match.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Moving on to our Army Guard facilities maintenance component. Our first request on here is for an additional PCN, the admin officer one, that is 100% federally funded. The current workload for the admin staff within that division is unattainable, and the National Guard Bureau has recognized this and is willing to fully fund another PCN in that division to help with that workload. Our second request on here is for an additional $138,000 in equipment maintenance and lifecycle refresh. And what this is refresh for computers and monitors, and for generators around the state at our different armories. The generators is mostly for the upkeep cost, not necessarily the purchasing of these generators. And this is, again, 100% federally funded.
Are you at the end of your, is that on the previous slide? I think we had a question. So we'll take questions at the end of each slide. At this point, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. This is regarding slide 9. And it's just a quick question. I just wondered if you have best practices on how often you replace your computers. How long ago was it last?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I don't have that information on me, but I can get you that. Mm-hmm. Moving on to our next slide, this is our Air Guard facilities maintenance component. Our first request on here is for the Eielson janitorial services, and this is an increase in $50,000 in general funds. We've found that We're just unable to establish a janitorial contract with the previous allotted amount due to inflation and just cost of living. And so we are looking to increase that. Currently, the Air National Guard facilities there on Eielson Air Force Base is without janitorial service and has been since 2022. The National Guard members are currently doing their own janitorial service, so we are looking to increase that cost. And the second request on here is for maintenance and utilities cost. The National Guard has received a nose dock, which is a big hangar meant to service helicopters from the active duty side, and this is the funding that we would need to keep the lights on and do the maintenance costs for that facility.
So I have a question on this slide. You were funded the $99,000 for janitorial?
Chair Johnson, that is correct.
And you didn't use any of that at all?
We have not been able to get a contract. We've had it out to bid multiple times, and we've not been able to get a contract on that.
So you didn't have, like, anyone that just did partial contracting or partial cleaning for that amount?
We've put it out multiple times and have not been able to get a bid on it.
So the 50,000 additional, so it'd be 150,000. I mean, I guess I'm just wondering, I don't want to get hung up on $150,000, but I just want to make sure that you came up with that number out of, you know, after some thought and know that that's what it's going to get you where you need to go.
Chair Johnson, that is correct. We do believe we'd be able to get a contract with that additional funding.
Thank you.
Moving on to our Alaska Military Youth Academy. The request here is for $1.9 million in additional federal authority, and we are also taking a decrement in $543,000 in general funds. Working with NGB, we were able to find that we could charge the federal government more for personal services costs through our master cooperative agreement. And it's not a like-for-like match. We can't go $1.9 million in federal authority, a decrement in $1.9, because as our match goes up in federal authority, our match in GF is going to go up as well. And that's why you don't see a like-for-like cost. But we did identify this $543,000 that we would be able to give back.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to the Chair. And Madam Chair, provide me a little bit of allowance here because it's the only opportunity we're going to get to look at this. Could you just give me a brief description of what happens at the military, how many students you have, how long is the program, those kinds of things, just a quick overview.
Through the Chair. It's roughly 85 right now. Our goal is 125 or more, but post-COVID, unable to really get to that point. It is a military school in roughly 8 weeks, and what they do is they bring people in. There is an option to get a GED. There's an option to get a diploma, and there's an option to go back to their high school. But I can speak from personal experience. My wife has had a couple female cadets that she sponsored over the years. I'm a big fan. It is life-changing because it gets the kids when they're at a very critical part in their high school career and gets them back on track. They have a very good reputation to do that. So that's what they do. It's a military school, but of course I sat in recently on a class, great academic instruction, and that is their goal, to get them back to one of those three places, back to high school, the GED, or potential for a diploma. And many do tend to go in the military as well.
Call up.
And just for, if nothing else, the public's knowledge, kids are assigned there because of past legal issues, or do they apply to the school?
It's all volunteer.
It's all volunteer. Okay.
All volunteer, and they come from all over Alaska. We have a high representation from rural Alaska, too.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Moving on to our next slide. This is Office of the Commissioner component. Our first request on here is an additional $750,000 for the Alaska Distributed Learning Program. The Distributed Learning Program is classrooms at different armories around the state that soldiers could go to, members could go to take classes and certified training. The program is looking to expand a little bit and has asked us to work on that, and they're willing to put forward an additional $75,000 in federal receipt authority. Our second request on here is for a Human Resource Consultant 1. The Human Resource Consultant 1 is, the majority of this is related to our ASDF expansion request that we have later on in our slide presentation, although there is an increased workload for our one HR position within the department that this request would help in a backup capacity. The great deal on this one is we're getting a full-time position, and about only a third of it is general funds. The rest of it we can charge to other divisions or to the federal National Guard Bureau.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the wonderful folks at DMVA. So at the bottom of the slide, it says, obviously, you're talking about it, the status of drill and the activations in reference to the Alaska Defense Force. I'm curious, I believe the Guard still effectively trains out of state. Is there any plans to maybe start utilizing the Northern Warfare Training Center as active duty armory? Kind of plans to turn that into an actual training center for active duty folks? Is the Guard or the Defense Force kind of get in on that? To General Sachs, I suppose.
Sure. Yes, we're looking to do anything that's Arctic, and that includes the school you speak of. We are considered the Arctic experts because we live here, and I've heard even recently from the 11th Air Division commander that he considers the National Guard the Arctic experts. So that was quite a compliment, and we want to go forward and make sure that we're being good examples of how to function here. It's not a normal place for potential training, and I think there's a growing respect for the Arctic. And when you talk about the NORTHCOM mission, Northern Command mission, about protecting the homeland, part of that is protecting the Arctic, which means protecting Alaska. So yes, we want to be a part of that school.
Our next request is for the Alaska State Defense Force, and this would be standing up the Alaska State Defense Force as their own division within the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. This request is just shy of $2.1 million in general funds and 5 full-time PCNs, including a director position.
Representative Galvin.
I'm not sure if you drill down on this later, on where the $2.1 million in regard, I see a list. I'm just thinking about emergency equipment, and I know that the Guard, of course, has much that you'll be able to partner with to use, but I just wondered if you wanted to expand upon or if you would. It says fleet vehicles. I know that the Guard and other groups will be responsive to emergencies. Is this the full complete list of what you would need, you think, for you to be responsive in the types of emergencies that you are expecting?
Through the chair, yes. I'd like to comment on that. And Jerome Brown, you can jump in too. We go forward as a team, and there are certain things the Guard can do well, and there are certain areas that we are not. What we're trying to focus on, I mentioned very briefly earlier, the places within Alaska that we currently don't have troops, those are the places that I like to focus upon. And there's a lot of concentration, of course, on the road system because that's where the majority of the people are. But I think it can come at the detriment of the people who live off the road system. And so what we really want to do is get the people and the equipment to the smaller places that you have to fly to, take a boat to. Because if there is a disaster in those places or even something short of a disaster that wouldn't require a full upstate response, if we have the people there with the equipment there, then we can respond more quickly. So that is the hope, and I'll let General Brown talk about some of the specifics about the equipment that we have on the list.
Through the chair, to your specific question about the fleet vehicles, if the Guard response is available, we can ride in them, but if they're not available, I would have to transport my own people with another vehicle. So we need vehicles to move large groups of people from one place to another to respond to a disaster. And along with other emergency equipment, again, we respond to all kinds of emergency all times a year. And I need additional survival equipment because if I send someone to rescue someone and they're not equipped, now I have two victims. So I need additional equipment, survival equipment, so that when I send somebody out, they're ready to stay for long periods of time.
A follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So when we're referring to equipment and getting people to rural areas, are you referring to airplanes? And how are you going, if you could give me a little more detail on that, 2.1 million is, it goes fast if you're talking about airplanes.
No, we would not be buying airplanes. If we have to fly, we will charter or buy a commercial ticket. This would be for wheel vehicles, other off-road vehicles, once you're there to respond to emergency and stay out long periods of time.
Thank you. And I just wanted, for the record, that was General Brown.
General Brown.
Yeah, no. Very good. Oh, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And across the table, my colleague also has had her finger out. I think my question is for General Sachs, but it may be General Brown, and that is, especially when we're talking about interest in putting the Alaska State Defense Force in places that used to have armories, I've had a conversation with General Brown, so I have my father served 20 years with the State Defense Force, some knowledge, but I know there's some very clear, or used to be, big barriers to the State Defense Force using the equipment of the National Guard or being in their armories, and so again, trying to repopulate those armories, what are the legal restrictions against doing that? Do we already have agreements that if we stood up a State Defense Force unit in a location that used to have an armory that National Guard no longer has active troops in, that we get to use it? Or are all those things dependent on us first putting $2.1 million and then we can get those agreements? But help me understand, because 2.1 doesn't go very far in rural Alaska, especially standing up things, unless we're going to use existing equipment. But my sense is the feds don't give away their equipment or authority to turf or things very easily.
Through the chair, good question. And as long as I'm in this position, it really is one team, one fight. And so what we do have at the armories right now and have had for years, the ASDF can use the armories. And especially in places where we don't have a whole lot of troops, Kodiak, for example, Kotzebue, for example, we're always trying to recruit on the National Guard side, but in some places, such as Kodiak, the State Defense Force force is by far the largest force in the area. And so they have free use of all the armories. It's on paper as far as the agreement, but that is not an issue. That will not be an issue in the future as well. As far as using equipment, if it's federal equipment, to use the example about the airplane, yes, they're not going to be flying the airplane, but I'm going to get them on the airplane to get out to where they need to get to. So as seamless as I can make it and as legal as I can make it, it really is no difference. They wear the same uniform, and I want them responding together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh. Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, I think this is probably for General Brown, but so this amount is for the five PCNs only, and I noticed that they're permanent full-time, but I'm wondering, it sounds like you're trying to do this to respond to emergencies and things, natural disasters and things that kind of come and go and ebb and flow. Can you give me a sense of what the five permanent full-time would be doing when there is an emergencies? What are they organizing in different areas? Kind of just give me a sense of what their responsibilities would be.
Through the chair, General Brown. Representative, five people, right now we have approximately 200 people. We want to go up to 500 people. And with that comes a lot of record keeping, application processes, background checks, and preparing training, getting the subject matter experts to training assemblies, and organizing all that. And at this present time, we're doing this through volunteer force, and which they show up 1 week in a month. And it's hard to keep track of that because I want to show as we respond that we are professionals and that we have a track record of all our training, all our applications. And so it takes a full-time staff to do that. And because we're around the state, they're not in one place, so it's even become more cumbersome having, at this current time, I have 23 detachments around the state. And to track all of that information and keep up to date with everybody and let everybody know what's going on and be ready to respond to emergency, I need a certain amount of full-time staff that can be on the job and have things ready to go when the state calls us to respond.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to our last request. This is just a technical item. Last year, in the current year's budget, FY23, the Alaska State Defense Force was funded $400,000 and some change. And this is just moving that out of the Office of the Commissioner and into the Alaska State Defense Force component should that request go through.
So on that note, I guess I would like to go back to slide slide six. And so if you move that division, the division to, how does that change this org chart? Would it change that at all?
It would not change.
Okay. The Alaska State Defense Force is, I mean, even though it doesn't change this, it would make it still be under the same in the same line of command, so to speak, and it's just giving it division status.
Yes, that is correct. And they would still report through General Brown to me, just like the National Guard and the Naval Militia.
Very good. Thank you. I am not. Oh, do you have a question, Representative Cronk? Yes. Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair, and thank you, General Saxon Brown, for your service. My first 8-9 years of life around Elmendorf, so I'm very fond of Elmendorf. And if we're done, I have a totally separate thing I would. I don't want to.
I think we are done.
Okay, yes. And this might be for General Sachs. So, living in my district, Fort Greeley is the only military base not served by railroad. And especially as the winters have, we built the $200 million bridge to get across the Tanana, and that's pretty much the extent of it. And seeing the convoys, I see reports all the time of them, running off the road. How could we get that last spur done to Fort Greeley so we're alleviating? I know military loves rail. That's how we get stuff there. How could you help to get that pushed through?
Yeah, through the chair. I like this question. I've heard a version of it before, and yes, done some not actual time at Greeley, but go there quite a bit. And I will say this. That mission set, in my opinion, needs to have a redundant access. So I'm looking holistically at the entire state, not just at Fort Greeley, but every place within the state. And, for example, can we go back to the slide that has the second slide with all the armories? Here's my issue. I need to be able to get forces any place within the state. This is our area of operations. So a lot of the airfields, this is kind of getting at your question, they need to be at least 8,000 feet. And if they are, a lot of them are very short right now. I can get every airframe that we have, the KC-135, the tanker, the C-130, the C-17. Fort Greeley is very similar. I believe that we should have access to Fort Greeley in every means possible, because I remember a couple of years ago, you probably recall as well, we had an issue with the road, and the road went down, and the only way to get there was through rail. So there's going to be, with my commissioner hat on, a very comprehensive study and request to go forward that we make the entire state accessible, and that would include Fort Greeley. So that will come with me, not in uniform, and in my commissioner status. I just want to let you know that that's something that we're working on, working through the congressional delegation to make sure that we pose it to the people here at the state level, but also the federal level as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to General Saxon, probably General Brown. First, I'm going to point out that probably a shout out for your S3 folks having to coordinate all of that map in terms of logistic and supply and personnel. But my question is, as you stand up the Defense Forces folks, how is that that coordination going to kind of work between, let's say, the National Guard aspects and the Defense Forces? I'm just curious, what's the decorum protocol? I mean, how are we actually integrating these forces into this pretty complicated system that we have in Alaska?
And through the chair, I want to say shout out to S3 as well. Those are our operations folks, so good job, S3. But the way it works, at least within this state, it really does all go through Unified Command. Because if there's a disaster, it goes through the SEOC, the State Emergency Operations Center, and then all assets to include the National Guard, potentially active duty if we have a dual status commander, and certainly the State Defense Force would all funnel through the same chain of command. There would not be anyone working separately. And we've had a lot of practice with this recently with the typhoon response. It wasn't the National Guard going out by itself. It wasn't the State Defense Force activating by itself. It really was everybody rowing together, and that's done through unified command. And they report to me, and I report to the governor.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you for presenting today. Thank you for being here. And I believe that with no anything else you would like to add for us before you go?
We appreciate
it. All right. Well, we appreciate you being here. So thank you very much. We're going to take a brief Eddie's. We'll have Eddie's until 2:15 to bring forward back the court system. Record. Let's see here. Next up, we have a presentation, a budget overview from the Alaska court system. We have Doug Wolliver, Acting Deputy Administrative Director. You would come forward, place yourself on the record, and go ahead and start your presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Doug Wolliver. I'm the Acting Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska court system. The court system just exists mainly for one purpose, and that's to decide cases and legal issues that come before the court. Our mission statement makes us directs us to do that as efficiently and as fairly and as expeditiously as we can during times of budget crises or pandemics. The two challenges we have are in the efficiency or the expeditiously and category, and also in the accessibility. Of course, if you have lots of budget cuts, you get less and less accessible. We've had court closures, or at least in the afternoons, loss of jury trials, those types of things. Those are our challenges in times of stress, but nevertheless, all the decisions we make in the management of the court system is with these goals in mind. And this is who we are. This shows you that what you see in probably a lot of other slides as well, that for the most part, state government in Alaska and every other state is mostly we're an executive branch. That's what the government mostly is. But the judicial branch and the legislative branch, you can see we make up a small but very, very important and critically important slice of the overall budget for the state of Alaska. And this is where the money for the court system goes. Mostly, like the state is mostly executive branch, the courts are mostly trial courts. That's where most of our employees are. That's where most of our judges are. That's where most of the cases are. And even the therapeutic courts, which is a separate appropriation in our budget, is still an entity that takes place within the trial courts. We are mostly trial courts. But we also have a court administration, of course, and appellate courts, which would be a Supreme Court and Court of Appeals. And this is how our budget breaks down in terms of kind of which things we fund. And mostly we're personal services. That's over 75% of our budget is employee costs, and that would be all things related to employees, salaries and benefits. And the next biggest thing that makes up our budget are our facilities, contractual things. But mostly those are the leases we pay to both state and municipal landlords, as well as private landlords, costs for maintenance, costs for security contracts, janitorial contracts, those types of things. That is almost all of our budget. And you'd find those types of budget expenditures in any court system in the country. But one of the things that makes the Alaska courts not exclusively unique but still unusual is that we're a unified court system. I think there are only 8 other unified court systems in the country, and that means there's just the state court system. We have a federal court system, of course, but we're just the state court system. We don't have municipal courts. We don't have county courts, as most other states do. This leads to lots of efficiencies. We have one court administration, not a court administration for every single county in the state. We also benefit from the fact that a lot of the other justice agencies are also unified. There is a correctional system in lots and lots of states. Of course, there are county courts across the state. When we have a correctional issue with the court system, we can deal with the commissioner of the Department of Corrections. The same with the Department of Law, all the Public Defender Agency. There are 2 municipal prosecuting offices, but for the most part, it's the Department of Law, Public Defender Agency. And that means with whether we're dealing with the legislature or amongst ourselves, it's very efficient to have unified systems, and we're fortunate to have that. And the types of things that impact the workloads that affect all of us, There are a number of things that affect workloads. The most obvious you would imagine would be population. As your population goes up, your workloads or caseloads go up. But there, and if it drops, you would expect your cases to drop. But there are other things that also have a significant impact, and frequently a much bigger impact. Things like police resources or law enforcement resources in a community. If the Anchorage Police Department is short a whole bunch of police officers, arrests in Anchorage go down. If they have a, they're fully staffed, or if they get federal funding for some additional officers, caseloads go up. The economy also can affect things. In general, it's harder to measure, but in general, people with jobs get in trouble less often than people without jobs. And of course, there are lots of statutory changes that impact workloads, whether cases are bumped from a misdemeanor to a felony, or dropped from a felony to a misdemeanor, or turned from a misdemeanor to a minor offense. All those types of changes can impact the workloads. And the workload is spread out in the court system at various different levels. We are mostly clerical. That's what over 660 of our 772 positions are clerical. But we have 5 Supreme Court justices, 4 Court of Appeals judges. We used to have 3, but the year before, we added a 4th. 45 Superior Court judges. That's where those are the biggest category of case judges that we have. Those are the judges with general jurisdiction. They handle all the felony cases, property law cases, family law cases. All of those types of things go to the Superior Court. District court judges have a more limited jurisdiction. They handle misdemeanors and small claims and minor civil things, cases. And then we have magistrate judges, which can be anywhere from a full-time lawyer position in a major community to a part-time non-lawyer position in a small rural community. And this is where we are. We're in a total of 40 different locations around the state of Alaska. And Madam Chair, this bottom section of the chart comes from a question you asked last year, which was, so where are all those employees? Well, this shows you where they are. How many are in the 1st District, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th? It comes no surprise that the 3rd District, which is South Central Alaska, includes some of our biggest courts, Kenai, Anchorage, Palmer. That's where the vast majority of all judges and court employees are in Alaska. But we do have 40 different court locations altogether. The large dots are our Superior Court locations, and then the smaller dots are areas where we just have magistrate judges. And across the state of Alaska, in all those 40 different locations, these are the contacts that we have with Alaskans. One of the, I think, most interesting aspects of this slide, 3,500 jurors. We're back to having jury trials, and our jury trial rate is back up just about where it was prior to the pandemic. So we had 3,500 jurors last year, which kind of gives you an idea of how many people serve on juries in Alaska. But one of the things that I think is interesting, and it should be of interest to your constituents, is the you'll see on here we have 6,268 contacts with a family law self-help center. The self-help center was started a number of years ago, and our current director, who used to run that program, is a national expert on self-help centers and speaks across the country on that subject. And that's a place, both a phone call where you can talk to an actual person, and a website, which is on the top banner of our webpage under self-help services. There are hundreds and hundreds of forms that we've developed for people who want to try to resolve their legal issues or facilitate the resolution of their legal issues themselves without a lawyer. There are people to talk to. There are videos to watch. There are links to all kinds of resources. It's a very, very handy resource for lots of different subjects. It specializes mostly in family law matters, but also probate cases, guardianship. There's just a wealth of information there. And as you can see here, court view searches remain popular, and almost 7 million visits to our website overall. The trial court caseloads have not changed dramatically from last year. Everything is up a little bit, but still well within kind of the average where it surfs from year to year. There's one exception to that, and that's Palmer. Palmer has seen an increase in caseloads. Palmer is now the busiest in terms of cases per judge, the busiest court in Alaska. This has been we've been anticipating this coming. That is the area of Alaska that is growing the fastest. I understand that last year, I think I looked it up, there are 110,000 people living in the Mat-Su Valley right now. The biggest, this almost the single cause for this significant increase in the caseload in Palmer is an increase in involuntary mental commitments. It's a type of probate case, and the reason it has increased from, as you can see, 583 in FY20 to over 1,000 this past year is that the Mat-Su Regional Hospital opened a facility that can take these cases now. Then they can handle people with who are being involuntarily committed. That meant that the cases that would have gone to Anchorage are now all being handled in Palmer. Now, the Anchorage numbers have gone up as well. Palmer isn't unique in the fact that their probate cases are rising. They're rising almost everywhere across the state and, incidentally, across the nation. They call it the silver tsunami. The baby boomer generation ages, you're going to see more and more probate cases all across the country. Palmer has been particularly impacted, though, because of this new facility and the increase in cases that are tied to that. And in fact, what I mentioned earlier, there are other things that can drive caseload other than just population and things like that. This is a good example. Palmer would still probably have in the 500 to 600 range of commitment cases were it not for that facility. But now that they have it, people can bring that in the local court.
All right. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Wolver, I just want to make sure, because there's sensitivity, as there should be, about commitment cases. But you've got it listed here as probate cases. So that could just be a dispute over someone's will, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes. Commitments are a subcategory of probate cases, but it is the commitment cases that have seen the big increase. There's a slight increase in wills and estate cases as well, but the big jump that's responsible for going from fewer than 600 to over 1,000 is commitment cases.
So this is slightly off the budget area, but since I think we have time, and we've had a high-profile commitment case in Palmer, would you just walk through just a really high level how a commitment, so how like someone calls in or however it would be the involuntary, they call somebody, I don't know who, I haven't done it myself, and then there's a court order, somehow the court does something and somehow something happens to go back to the troopers and then the troopers bring this person in. Would you put a few details to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'll give you a high level because detail is beyond my knowledge. But in general, you file a petition, and it can be anybody, a family member, a law enforcement officer. It can be a medical health provider. They file a petition with the court alleging certain things that would bring them within the scope of the statute. The court appoints someone to take a look at that issue to see if there seems to be some merit to it. If there is, the court can issue an order for that person to be involuntarily committed. That order is then transmitted to law enforcement directly from the court along with a transport order so that the police have both the order that says this person is being involuntarily committed and here's an order that they be transported to, whatever the appropriate facility is. That's how the process is, how it generally works.
So if someone has a commitment order, it's going to come from the court?
Madam Chair, yes, it has to come from the
court. That's right. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that was on the record. Okay. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Wolver, do you have any sense of that in, and let's just call it 500, that increase of 500, if any of those, are those 500 discrete individuals, or is it, you know, is could somebody have had five different commitment orders and count as those? And I am curious as to whether we've seen a decrease in, say, the Anchorage court of an equal number.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, those would be individual cases. So it is possible that someone, there may have been a petition filed for a person more than one time, and it could have been granted more than once, or it could have been denied more than once, but it could be, those are individual cases. And then these cases would have come to Anchorage. So Anchorage's number is probably 650 or so lower than it would have been. It's still higher than it used to be because it's still going up in Anchorage, as well as I think there are two courts across the state that didn't see an increase over the last several years. But those would have been Anchorage cases, and so the Anchorage case increase is much smaller than it would.
And then, Madam Chair, one follow-up.
So
in the Department of Corrections data, those their numbers reflect Title 47 holds, which are the same population of individuals. People are being held not on a criminal charge, but on a commitment out of self-harm and self-risk. Do the Department of Correction Title 47 holds reflect in those numbers? And is any of this because we reopened Palmer Correctional Facility, so besides Mat-Su Health, but we've also reopened Palmer Correctional Facility, and if it's having a Title 47 hold there, that it would need to come to the court and get one of these?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I am getting to the end of my knowledge, expertise on this, but this would be anytime someone is going to be, anytime a petition is filed to commit anybody, it's in this number.
Thank you.
And this brings us to how we're responding to that. So this is our list of increment requests. In order to address this increase in cases in Palmer, we're asking for it's a magistrate judge who's a standing master, which is a designated term for someone who does work in one specific area, to handle these this increase in this type of probate case. It's a standing master along with a clerk. This 600 cases, the number of cases per Superior Court judge in Palmer is over 700 cases already, and this is less than a Superior Court judge, although I can tell you that before very many more years, we'll be coming to you with a request for additional Superior Court judges in Palmer as well. Last year, you appropriated funds for us to do the planning and design for an expansion of the Palmer Courthouse. So this is a step that is a small step toward what will be a bigger step in the future, I'm sure, as the caseloads continue to grow in Palmer. But this is a request for a standing master to work who would work exclusively on this type of probate case. All the other increment requests that we have for this year merely reflect increased costs of doing business. The $750,000, that's just increased costs for our leases, both increased costs to the state and the facilities where we occupy state facilities, increased leases. That, you know, most leases have a consumer price index factor that goes into it. We have security screening costs. I think in the prior presentation by Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, talked about their inability to get janitorial contracts with the prices they had. Well, we're in the same situation with our security screening. We're going back out to bid for that. And we're going to have to pay more than we did in the past. So that's what that is. The court-appointed attorney costs. The court system is responsible for legal representation, appointing counsel and legal representation in certain types of cases where there's a legal right to an attorney, but the statutes don't designate who's supposed to provide that lawyer. In those cases, those lawyers are provided by the state. Just like the Office of Public Advocacy, provides a whole bunch of lawyers in certain types of cases. Both us and the department, well, the Office of Public Advocacy are looking for an increase from $75 an hour to $100 an hour, which is what we pay those contract lawyers. And again, the only reason is it's getting harder and harder to find lawyers to fill those appointments. And then finally, juror meals, that just reflects it's almost exclusively Bethel. The per diem rate for Bethel, as well as the rest of the state, was about $60 a day. That simply doesn't pay for three meals a day for jurors in Bethel any longer. So it's a relatively small amount, but it does mean that the jurors can actually get three meals in Bethel.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Wolliver, on security screening costs, when I was a freshman here some time ago, we were reminded that, I think particularly in the first judicial district where we're sitting now, there were courthouses that didn't enjoy the same security as other courthouses. In Anchorage, for example, you'd have to move heaven and earth to make your way somewhere you shouldn't be armed, for example. Can you say with confidence now that every at least superior court courthouse or chamber is secured the extent that they need to be?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it still does vary a great deal. We have a single judge in our single judge locations, like in Kotzebue. We don't have the same level of security that we have in Anchorage.
Why? Why would we have any distinction?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is just the amount of traffic that they get in those smaller communities. And what we do have, when there's going to be, say, a felony trial or something in those communities, we have portable security screeners and stations that come to them. But to have full-time court security in those locations with the caseloads they have and the types of cases they have, we haven't spent the money in that area. These are our non-UGF requests. Again, this isn't general fund money. It's just the authority to receive money. There's a federal program that has a formula that the court receives a certain amount of money that's tied to numbers and types of child need of aid cases. Under that formula, we're entitled to about $450,000 in additional federal funding. This request asks us to be able to get the authority to receive this federal money. We have $304,000 in federal grant, additional federal grant authority, and that, let me just remind myself what that one is. This helps set up the new Veterans Court in Fairbanks, which was started this past year, and additional staffing to oversee some of the other grants that we have. The Mental Health Trust, every year, the Mental Health Trust is zero-based budgeting, so every year the money they gave you comes out of the budget and comes back into the budget. So this is just the authority to receive the money that we typically receive for the Mental Health Trust. They help support, as you probably know, an awful lot of our therapeutic court costs. And then we have $250,000 decrement in our non-federal grant authority, and that's just because several years ago we'd requested additional funding. We thought we were going to get a grant. We never did get grant. It's the cost of that program, which is the Palmer Infants and Children's Families with Infants and Toddlers Court. We never got a grant for it, so we're just taking away the authority to receive it.
Can I ask you a question about that then? So you didn't get the grant at all? I mean, ever? I thought that, or just recently?
Through the chair, we used to get some grant funding for that court from Matsu Health Foundation. This was another one we thought we were going to get from them, but it never panned out. It's in our base. And we just no longer need the authority to receive that particular grant that never developed.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair. So I have a question about the mental health trust money. Mm-hmm. So is it looks like the therapeutic court, the budget's around $7.8 million. And so is this $304,000 that they give you, does that all go to therapeutic courts, or are they giving you money for some different purpose?
Through the Chair, Representative Cologne, this goes all to therapeutic courts.
Okay. And can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Can you give me a short description of what the therapeutic court is?
I would love to. Here's my next slide on therapeutic
Perfect.
Courts. Okay. We're very proud of our therapeutic courts. Alaska has been a leader in this area. In 1998, an Anchorage judge, Stephanie Rhodes, created one of the very first mental health courts in the country. A year later, another Anchorage judge, Jim Wanamaker, created one of the very first, then it was called a DUI court in Anchorage. And in 2004, Judge Jack Smith in Anchorage created one of the nation's very first veterans courts. So we've been, it's a big part of kind of our approach to things. They take a lot of work. There's a lot of management involved with them, but they are terrific programs. The way the budget goes together, which is why I have it in here, it used to be prior to 2011, therapeutic courts, there would be an appropriation for legal services to the Department of Law, another to the Public Defender Agency, treatment services to the Division of Behavioral Health, or at least probation and things. Anyway, there are little pieces of therapeutic court-related money spread throughout the budget. The then co-chair of House Finance, Mike Hawker, thought, well, why don't we put them all in one place? Then we can better monitor how much these courts actually cost and better track how that money is being spent. So all that money now comes into our budget. It's a separate appropriation, so money appropriated to the therapeutic courts appropriation can't be used outside of that. And then, so $1.8 million of that is actually spent, you know, within the court system. The rest of that, almost $8 million, goes out to Division of Behavioral Health for probation and things. The attorneys who have those cases basically bill their services to the court system, and they're paid out of all of this appropriation. So the money all comes and goes through this appropriation, and it makes it easier to track. And it's been helpful for, I think, the whole system to know how much it costs and where those funds are going.
Representative Josephson.
Through the Chair, Mr. Wolliver, what would we see as the FY23 therapeutic court budget?
The FY23? Let's see. It would be... Rhonda, online is our budget guru, Rhonda McLeod, I think. Rhonda, if you don't mind, could I ask her for our last year's request?
Rhonda McLeod, did you hear the question?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Through the Chair, this is Rhonda McLeod, Chief Financial Officer for the Alaska Court System. Our FY23 authorized budget was just shy of $7 million.
Thank you.
And that's it. Happy to take any other questions that you have.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair to our Courts and System folks. First off, I'd like to thank you for the Kathleen Carlo quote. My wife did Alaska Native artistry with Kathleen Carlo, so she'll appreciate that. I do have two questions for you. Now that I got the polite out of the way, I'll hit you with the hard one. So I didn't see anything regarding the court system's vacancies and how that is basically impacting our backlog. We talked about increasing in cases. So what is the court system's vacancy rate currently? And then I have a follow-up after that, Madam Chair.
Sure. Our official vacancy rate is supposed to be 7%. So we're funded at 93%. We're supposed to have a 7% vacancy rate. Our vacancy rate right now is just a little bit under 11%. It has been getting better. We have, as of I think Monday when I last asked, we have a total of 65 vacant positions in throughout the court system. We, but things are getting better. A year ago, in just a category of those vacancies is our Superior Court clerical staff, which is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we're mostly trial courts. That's where most of the work is. We're mostly Superior Court. So a year ago, we had 39 vacant positions. As of today, we have 17 vacant positions in that area. So we've started to get better. The raise that we received last year has cut down on the length of time it takes to recruit and fill those positions. It used to be about, I think, 84 days. Now it's down, it's coming down, and now it's down to about 51 days to fill a position. So we've made some improvements in that regard.
Yeah, my follow-up, Madam Chair, if you would. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Director Wolliver. So on that subjective note, given the fact you had the backlog and you've been bringing on staff to kind of get that mitigated, I'm sure that you've probably clocked a several amount of overtime hours to try to deal with that. I was curious if that had been reflected in the budget or not, the amount of overtime being clocked to deal with the backlog.
Representative Staff, we actually have almost no overtime in the court system. For any employee to get overtime, they have to get permission from the administrative director. So it very, very, very rarely happens. In fact, I think our total overtime for last year was in the $20,000 range, and that was only because that, and those are typically tied to a judge who travels to another location with clerical staff to cover a trial, things like that. So we actually have very, very little overtime.
Thank you.
Well, looks like we have no more questions. And it looks like we came to the end of your presentation. So thank you very much, Mr. Wolliver.
Thank you.
Our next meeting will be Thursday, March 2nd at 1:30 p.m. We will hear the budget overview for the Department of Fish and Game, and the presentation on the long-term Medicaid forecast has been canceled. Also, at this time, I'm making note that House Finance Committee will be canceled on Friday. And seeing no further business before the committee, at 2:48, we are adjourned.